of food prices. For example, before these rains came, I would buy a kilo of rice at, say, it's about 200. Of course, it's about 50 cents or $1, USD dollar. And but now I can buy it. It is double, I would say. So the price of food is higher than normal at the moment, but also fuel, diesel is higher than normal. I have a car, but I have decided to park it for now. I cannot use it, my private car.
Because
My
gas
private
is too
car.
expensive.
The gas is too expensive for me to afford. So I have decided just to park it for now.
So then if you're not driving in your car, how are you traveling? You're taking a dala dala?
I'm taking the dala-dala, the public transport. That's why you find I have to experience the challenges related to the public. But if I have my own car, then I can find my own shortcuts and ways to get to my place, to the places where I want to.
And the dala dalas are packed. I can imagine. I've traveled on dala dalas and they're just packed like sardine cans.
Yeah, some of them are, of course, not some, almost all of them, when you get into the Dalladas, full, very full packed. So, and sometimes it is very dangerous. We thank God that we don't have COVID-19 at the moment, but it is dangerous for even what we call the communicable diseases too. It is full. And I was talking about the other impact that I have noticed. It goes to the students, especially pupils, primary school pupils. Because here in Dar es Salaam, you find pupils, girls and boys, have to travel longer distances going to school. So you find when it rains, it becomes very difficult for students and these pupils to go out and travel to go to school. Even coming back from school it's really challenging at the moment. So it has affected even the education system because you find some parents tell their children not to go to school because they are afraid of the weather, which is unpredictable. Anything can happen to their children. So this affects the education development of the children at the moment.
Tell me where you're living, Joseph out. I can see a room behind you. These are looks like plaster walls, and the ceiling is wooden planks that are going this way and that, and it looks like you've got a zinc roof of some sort. Looks kind of interesting. Where do you live? What's your living situation like? And you were telling me that because of the rains, you were concerned that some embankment was going to break and your house was going to get flooded.
Yes, where I'm living is really the soil is, I don't know what can you call it. The soil is not soil, it is soft soil, I mean, it's the soil that we have around. And it affected it, the rains has affected many people around, including myself. And my house also has been affected. And the normally here we have fences which we build by blocks. So my fence fell down and caused a lot of challenges to me here. So as I speak now, I have some engineer, civil engineers, two civil engineers outside who are working on my house, trying to cement the foundation around the area around my foundation to ensure that the rains should not continue damaging my house. But I have experienced the damage also of my house because of the rains.
And you own your
Because
house? Do you own your house?
I own it, and as you say, you see the roof behind me. It is all It is under construction. So this is the roof that you see above me. It's the roof that I'm still working on. But it is very expensive to build a house in Dar es Salaam. And if you experience damages of this kind from rains, it is really very costful. I would say it is very costful and painful. And normally here, the government does not come along, come and help immediately until you really show evidence that you have been affected by the rains and that government is liable to support you. Otherwise, you have to deal with the situation on your own.
And what's your work situation like, Josephat? What are you doing to earn a living?
At the moment, I'm working as a consultant on research. I do help NGOs conduct audience research, but also some surveys that they want to carry out. For example, recently, I was working with the Women's Media Association. These are journalists, women journalists who have formed an association and are dealing with women journalist issues in the media. So they consulted me to get out a research for them to find out how women are surviving financially in the media at the moment after COVID-19. And also I do help the media in Tanzania with the mentoring class. So I run trainings to journalists, especially younger journalists, but also I mentor them. So I earn a living in such a situation. But also I use some of my time teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam, teaching there as a tutorial assistant. And that helps me here and then to collect some money.
So you're earning an income, more or less.
Less, I would say it is less because it is seasonal. First of all, it is seasonal. Yeah. It is not consistent, and even these opportunities are not available always. So I have to be very, very clever in saving whatever I aim. So also something like this here I'm doing with you when I contribute my stories to Green Planet Monitor, I can get something that can help my family and my children, of course, with the school fees and something like that.
What's your family situation like? You've got a wife, you've got children?
Yes, I have a wife. Of course, she is not working at the moment, but she studied sociology, but it has been difficult for her to get a job. So she doesn't have a job yet. I have two children. One is 16 years old, Josephine. She's called Josephine. And the last one is Joanne, 3 years old. So I have, I would say, compared to my friends and other people that I see around me, I have a little bit small family. But as you know, Dave, in Africa, we have extended families. So I have some dependents that really depend on me, and they need my support. They need a hand to lift them up. So I have some dependents too, including my own mother, because my father died when I was still young. So I have the responsibility to take care of my mother too.
Josephat, we just have a few more minutes left. What do you guys do to entertain yourselves in your little village just on the edge of Dar es Salaam? Do you listen to music? Are there festivals?
Oh, in the village we have dances, traditional dances, what we call ngoma. We have trumpets, we have traditional drums, we have guitars, and we have some other traditional instruments that we use in entertaining ourselves. We have different ceremonies in the village. For example, when a family has a wedding, that is one of the ceremonies we have during the harvest season. That means all families in the village at least have their own farms, small farms. So after the harvest, we normally get together to celebrate, to thank God, and to eat, to drink together. So during that time, we have a lot of dances, we have a lot of comedies, people read tell stories. Of course, we don't have books in the villages, but we have old people who give stories that are very inspiring and very compelling stories. Some of them are very thrilling, you know, they tell stories of old ages, and the young people play football, and we go racing, we run, something like that. So we have a lot of things that we are doing in the villages as collective. We have a communal life in the village.
Josephat, it's been a delight speaking with you, and it would be wonderful to have you on the Green Planet Monitor on a more or less regular basis, just as our correspondent in Dar es Salaam. Dar es Salaam is a kind of a funky city. I recall visiting Dar es Salaam, and it's got charm, it's got character.
Yes, I remember one of the stories that our audiences can go back to, one of my stories that I contributed, was about the SGR is the standard gauge rail that was being built in Tanzania. Of course, it was a rapid transport project. And it was meant to reduce the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam.
And so has that been built? Is that rapid transit system now built in Dar es Salaam?
Yes, it is built, but it has not covered most of the area, which was expected to cover. So, of course, it has reduced to some extent the traffic jam in the city, but it has not covered many areas. So, as a result, the traffic jam continues. But I remember it's now almost 10 years since I covered that story on the rapid transport in Dar es Salaam. And the then president was called Jakaya Kikwete, had told the people in Tanzania that transport system would eliminate the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam. Because by that time, the traffic jam was causing almost $1 million loss almost every month in Dar es Salaam because of the traffic jam. People are not reaching to work on time. Business are stuck always on the road. And transportation of the goods, for example, we have DRC. Countries like Rwanda, Burundi, DRC, Kenya, Botswana, Zambia, always depend on the harbor, Dar es Salaam harbor, to get business. But when there is a traffic jam, then it's a problem always for them. So to conclude this thought, I would say the rapid transport system that was meant to rescue the traffic jam in Dar es Salaam has not worked.
So much more to talk about, Josephat Mwanzi. We're running out of time here on Zoom, but you're going to come back on, and we're going to make this a more or less regular thing. So you take care out there in the heavy Tanzanian rains, and thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
It has been a pleasure for me, as always, Dave. I thank you very much.
Josephat Mwanzi is a journalist and radio trainer based in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania in East Africa, and an old friend of the Green Planet Monitor. We're hoping to hear from Josaphat regularly and pay him for his work. For as little as $5 a month, you'll be helping us to do just that. Subscribe to this weekly package of Earth news at greenplanetmonitor.net. Fossil fuel burning sends 37 billion metric tons of CO2 into Earth's atmosphere. A little over a tenth of those emissions, 4.1 billion tons, are associated with heating air and water in homes and buildings. So, clean ways to generate heat are in hot demand. Low electricity pumps pump heat from air to water, air to air, and from the ground. Then there's geothermal, piping water from beneath Earth's surface, where water gets very hot. Hemmo Abels is an applied geologist with the Delft Geothermal Heat Project at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. Two pipes are now being bored at TU Delft, a doublet they're called. 2.5 kilometers down, water temperature is 75 degrees and filled with natural gas. It'll get pumped up, the gas will be tapped, and the hot water will be used to heat campus buildings. Slightly cooler now, 50 degrees, that water will be sent through a grid to surrounding Delft homes. Total output, 8 megawatts of thermal energy. There are about 20 geothermal doublets around the Netherlands today. That could expand to 75 by 2025 and up to 700 by 2050, at which point the Netherlands is aiming to be CO2 emissions free. I spoke about the Delft Geothermal Heat Project with Hemmo Abels.
People are looking for sustainable energy, and the subsurface is one of the key sources. Hey. You see in the Netherlands that there is quite a public resistance growing towards windmills, solar panel farms.
Is there?
Yeah, because it uses space. I mean, people see the windmills, and if you work in the subsurface, you see after the now you see a big construction, but after the project, there's just two pipes basically coming out of the subsurface, and the rest is underground or in this building here next door where the heat exchangers are. So what you hear now, we see a drilling rig that's around 45 meters high, and we are drilling down to 2.5 kilometers, two deviated wells. One well is already finished, it goes to the east, it's 3 kilometers long and it's around a kilometer to the site, and the other well going north, also around a kilometer deviated. So at depth, they are 1.5 kilometer apart, the two wells. And what we're doing is we want to produce hot water, as I said, 75 to 80 degrees water from the formation at that depth, and then cool it down here, take the heat out in this building in the back of it, and then bring the colder water back into the subsurface. And then in the subsurface, the two wells are communicating. In the back of us here, that's actually very interesting. We see this building here, this is from the 50s. And in the top here, those are coal hoppers. That's where coal used to be brought in. And then the campus was heated with coal. And then somewhere in the 70s, that was transformed to methane. So to gas, natural gas, and we hope in 2 years' time it will be all on sustainable heat from the subsurface, so on water.
This one building and lots of other buildings around campus.
Well, this is only the building to produce the heat, and it has been produced here since the 50s, using coal first and methane now, and it will be heating the whole campus. not the newest buildings, because the newest buildings are very well insulated, and so they are heated at low temperatures. But the older buildings we have are not so insulated, and they are heated by at higher temperatures. So we can heat those. And the rest of the heat we bring to older buildings around in the city of Delft, where also higher energy heat is needed to heat them.
You're drilling now. When is it going to be complete? And when it's complete, what will you be... tell me about what you're planning on using this geothermal energy to heat.
Yeah, so we're drilling now. So we're drilling to 2.1 kilometers, a dublet system, where we retrieve hot water, a brine, in fact. So it's salt water that comes up. So there is heat exchangers at surface, and we send back to the same formation the same water that's cooled down. So we take out the heat and the gas that's in there, and then we pump the water back into the same formation. So it's a closed system in that sense. And we, with the heat, we want to heat the campus buildings of the university, and outside 5,000 to 10,000 houses of the city of Delft will be heated with that.
Which would save how much energy in terms of consumption of...
Yeah, I think it is 25 megawatt of energy. That's the whole system worth. In summertime, so you have a lot of months where you produce too much heat, because the heat demand of buildings is really focused on winter times and parts of the spring and parts of the fall. And then there's a lot of time where there's little heat demand and the well can still produce a lot of heat, the same amount of heat, of course. While in peak winter times, when it's really cold, then there is too much heat demand for the well. So what we also try to do is next summer, we will drill a whole set of extra less deep wells to 250 meters, where we will store the excess heat from the summertime for the peak moments of heat demand in winter.
You can actually heat up those aquifers.
Exactly. We heat up the shallow systems, the shallow aquifers. Also there we do a lot of research into how we can optimally do that, because such systems are normally not so efficient. Maybe you lose half of the heat that you pump in. So of course we want to optimize that to lose less, make it more efficient. So there is also a whole research component into that system. So something that's really needed is that there is more data gathering along with projects. Because what you can see in sustainable energy, that the margins are slim, and particularly these are low entropy systems.
So meaning low heat.
Low heat, yeah, exactly.
Low enthalpy.
Low enthalpy means low heat system. So economically, if you have a barrel of water of 75 degrees, well, if you wait too long, it's cold. So your money is gone. Eh? So it is very difficult to make an economic margin on a barrel of water. And it's much easier to make an economic margin on a barrel of oil. Because if you wait and the prices go up, you can sell it. And if the prices go down, you wait and you sell it later. So to make money with sustainable heat, with this kind of systems, is very difficult. So normally those companies, they gather as the minimal data possible, because data gathering is expensive. But it also means from each project, we learn little. And and it's difficult to optimize these systems because we have little knowledge and we learn little because the companies don't want to invest in data gathering. So,
and here we're talking about data on the subsurface, geology.
On the subsurface, but also on everything at surface, on scaling, on pumping, on pumps, and etc. These are all relatively new to a lot of engineers, but also there is little investments in science, in research into these kind of systems, because there is little money. Yeah, so it's good that the government is really boosting this now, or at least making money available to get more data and to get more science going, because we really need to, if we want the energy transition to really go faster and we want to move away from fossil energy, we really need a big boost of these systems. from multiple sides, it's a win-win because it is a source of energy that we have in the first place. So if there is a energy crisis, prices go up, it is also economically worth it to invest in geothermal energy. And we have the climate crisis, so we really need to change from fossil fuels to sustainable sources. And well, so in that sense, it's a win-win.
Hemmo Abels is a geologist at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. Read more about the Delft Geothermal Heat Project and geothermal heating in general at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
When Nesenthe Megaras, who'd had a squelch, gave it all away. What does it mean to bear witness? The act of witnessing is also the act of universal acceptance. Giving is intertwined with wealth and abundance, depending on the reciprocal relationship one has with land and community. It is this ideology that has helped indigenous nations maintain sustenance for centuries. Following Themaigaras' performance at SFE Gallery in fall 2022, who had a squelch, gave it all away. Guest participants were invited to recount the event in, as Hegaras describes, a collective remembering, a truth about an experience. Listen as participants Tanya Lukin-Linklater, Alisa Johnny Hawkins, and Mikhail DeAngeli share their witness encounters together in a conversation airing December 12th and 19th on Speaker from 10 to 11 a.m.
PFLY Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Maybe you're a parent, a family member, employer, a co-worker, an educator, a healthcare provider. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.